I'm going to talk to you today about the dollar, the role of the dollar as a global reserve currency. The dollar in the last couple of years has had a fair amount of bad press. It started to be used less and less in international transactions. There has been fairly fevered speculation about whether the Middle East will abandon its ties to the United States dollar. The Middle Eastern economies are looking to create their own monetary union. They have turned to the European Central Bank for advice on how to create the monetary union. The result is monetary union has been delayed several years in the Middle East. We've seen in Russia demands that gas exports be paid for in euros. Iraq today still invoices for oil in euros. The Indian authorities last year announced that they would no longer accept dollars as payment for entry into the Taj Mahal. International illegal drug transactions now take place more in euros than in dollars. And most telling of all, the international supermodel Giselle has announced to the world she will accept any currency for her work as long as it is not the US dollar. Since making that decision, the US dollar has risen in value. However, this is, I think, part of a trend where the dollar is used less as a global reserve currency. So, let us start by thinking about what a reserve currency is and looking at then how reserve currency fails. I'll then come on to look specifically at what's happening with the dollar at the moment before coming up with some conclusions. So what is a global reserve currency? Well, a global reserve currency, most obviously, is the currency that's held in reserve by central banks. And when the tabloid media, like the Wall Street Journal, talk about reserve currencies, that's normally what they're going on about. But in fact, a reserve currency is far more than what the Bank of England has got kicking around in its vaults. A reserve currency is also the currency that is held in reserve by the private sector in order to conduct international transactions. If you want to go and buy goods from Germany or from Japan or from the United States, you need to be able to pay for those goods. And in this day and age, the pound sterling is not normally accepted by international transactions. So you'll have to pay in a foreign currency. And if you're conducting your trade on a regular basis as a private sector company, you will hold a certain amount of foreign currency in reserve to facilitate those transactions. This is essentially an idle balance. It's money that's just sitting around earning either nothing or not very much at your bank. And the result is that when we consider a reserve currency, what we're basically talking about is currency that is not held for investment purposes, but currency that is primarily held for the purposes of transactions. Currency which basically doesn't earn any interest. So what's the scale of importance? Now this table, which I realize is a little difficult to read, gives the stock of foreign exchange reserves at the start of January 2007. This is the latest available data that we have. And the stock of foreign exchange reserves is pretty sizable. China at that point had reserves of around $1.1 trillion in the central bank, a reasonably impressive sum of money. $1 trillion doesn't go as far these days as it used to, but it's still a reasonably large sum of money. Today, the estimates put it closer to $1.5 trillion. Overall, the world's central banks do have fairly sizable amounts of reserves. The problem is that their reserves actually pale into insignificance when we compare those reserves to what actually goes on in the private sector. So what I'm looking at with this chart is the stock of foreign exchange reserves as a share of imports and the flow of foreign exchange reserves as a share of imports. In fact, the private sector is far more significant than central banks in terms of trade. And if you assume that international trade requires that you have to hold international currency in order to be able to make those transactions, then this would suggest that the private sector reserves that we have are actually far more significant than the public sector reserves. In fact, it is not central bank reserves that actually matter to reserve currency status. When we look at the actual importance of central banks in the world, it becomes a matter of considerable wonder that anyone actually pays any attention to central banks at all, particularly the ECB. This is the stock of foreign exchange reserves compared to the daily flow in the foreign exchange market. So in 2007, if every central bank in the world had thrown all of their foreign exchange reserves into the market, it would have accounted for less than 2% of the daily turnover in the foreign exchange market. These guys are not even a rounding error in terms of what goes on. So when we consider the overall flow that goes through foreign exchange markets, in fact, what the public sector does is really not that important. It is private sector reserves as much as public sector reserves that are going to matter in determining a currency's reserve status. So, if that's what reserve currencies are, how do reserve currencies fail? One of the earliest reserve currencies to fail was the Byzantine denarius, which the Persians undermined by minting their old gold coins. The Byzantine Empire was so upset that somebody was challenging the status of the denarius as the only gold coin in existence that they went to war with Persia and then lost, which fairly effectively undermined the status of the Byzantine denarius. Nowadays, things have moved on a little bit, and it's not absolutely essential to have a war in order to undermine reserve currency status, though it has to be said, having a war normally helps. The first thing that undermines reserve currency status is the central banks. In the early part of the 20th century, the pound sterling was still the main reserve currency in the world. But it was a reserve currency that was being challenged. And as we can see here, the challenge was coming from the French, as is so often the case, where the French were actually taking a larger share of central bank reserves. So the pound sterling was no longer the only currency that was being used by central banks around the world. Other currencies were starting to gain some market share. The pound sterling was still enormously important in 1913. It still dominated central bank reserves. And indeed, the faith in the pound sterling was particularly strong. Foreign central banks held sterling to the equivalent of 250% of the Bank of England's gold stock. In other words, there was a great deal of credibility from the Bank of England at that time. It's waned a little since. That meant that although there was a decline in the central bank use of reserves in sterling, it wasn't actually fatal to sterling's reserve status. However, we also saw around this time the rise of viable and liquid alternatives to sterling as a reserve currency. Now, the whole point of having a reserve currency is you need to get your hands on it quickly. A reserve currency is being used for transactions, which means you can't have an illiquid currency in order to conduct your transactions. It has to be liquid. It doesn't have to be the most liquid currency in the world. As long as you've got sufficient liquidity that you can access the currency in the suitable quantities and at basically sight demand, you don't have to be the most liquid currency in the world. One of the reasons why sterling was continuing to decline as a reserve currency after the First World War was the fact that the United States had started the Federal Reserve in 1913, and they started to discount bills, which means that the US dollar all of a sudden became a very liquid currency which one could readily translate into cash. Now, the fact that you need to be a liquid and viable alternative means that the idea that the Chinese renminbi is going to be a reserve currency anytime soon is laughable. You cannot get large amounts of Chinese renminbi. They still have large capital controls. The fact that you cannot transact very readily in the renminbi means that that is not going to be a reserve currency. And the illiquidity of money supply also means that there is absolutely no prospect of return to the gold standard anytime soon. There are still people who believe that gold is the only currency that counts. They're a weird and obscure breed. Many of them are our clients at UBS. They are gold bugs who think that gold is the only thing that could be credible as a currency. But the chart at the bottom of this page shows that they're not a credible reserve currency. The growth in the supply of gold has been lower than the growth in global trade every single year in recent economic history, bar 2001. What that means is, if you're using gold as your international reserve currency, gold as your transactions currency, you're committing to permanent deflation, because the volume of trade is ever growing faster than your money supply is going to be growing. You've got to be liquid and viable. Gold doesn't meet it. Why else do reserve currencies decline? Well, because of the private sector. Now, normally the largest trading country will provide the global reserve currency. In the period of the sterling dominance as a reserve currency, the UK was dominating global trade transactions. After the First World War, the pound sterling was in decline, partly because the UK was tending to lose market share. And what you found was that as sterling declined in terms of global market share, as it lost out at the markets of Latin America to the United States, for example, other countries would come in and insist that their country's currency would be the invoicing currency. And so you again got a decline in the world's reserve status. Political influence is a vague area, but political influence does have a role with reserve status. The force majeure, if you are the largest bully in the playground, you can force people to take your currency. Russia forced the ruble on Eastern Europe in the post-war era. As far as America was concerned, it could insist that transactions were being done in dollars. But as political force starts to fade, and as political opposition starts to rise, then you find that your ability to influence your partner trading partners is going to decline. People in Eastern Europe do not accept the ruble anymore. Russians don't accept the ruble anymore. I don't see why people in Eastern Europe are likely to do so. They are, however, accepting the euro, generally speaking, as a rising power. The Middle East doesn't accept the dollar in the way that it used to do. You don't get very far trying to pay for anything with dollars in Iran these days. In Iraq, it is still accepted, but only in certain areas. So you are starting to see, with political decline, a change in the role of the currency that is acting as the reserve. And finally, reserve currencies need to have at least a fairly credible store of value. If your store of value concept is fading, your reserve currency status is fading. The pound was a reserve currency back in the Middle Ages. In fact, it was one of the more dominant reserve currencies because the British government did not allow, or the UK government did not allow, clipping of coins. What happened was that every 10 years, all of the gold coinage in the UK was brought back into the mint and reminted to make sure that nobody was trimming the edges of the coins. Therefore, if you had a pound sterling, there was a reasonable chance that it was worth what it was supposed to be worth. Gold standards meant that there was a credibility in the store of value in the 19th century. But under the Bretton Woods scheme, that credibility started to fade, because the gold standard was based on what the Americans had in Fort Knox, backing the currency, and the Triffin dilemma came in. As Trefin pointed out, the US was increasing its obligations in dollars to the rest of the world as global trade expanded, but it wasn't increasing the amount of gold. Charles de Gaulle worked this out and facilitated the breakup of Bretton Woods by insisting that people paid the French in gold rather than in dollars, because he felt the dollar no longer had a credible store of value, one of the main things which started the decline of the dollar as a reserve currency. Hyperinflation will pretty much kill off any aspirations of reserve currency status, and because hyperinflation is such a dangerous prospect, it is actually something which can linger as a negative for reserve status for years. The German mark has never really had reserve status after the hyperinflations of 1923 and 1948. In fact, even in the 1970s and the 1980s, when the German mark was more credible as a currency, its reserve status was never properly established. And it's always, as a single currency, competed with the UK in terms of reserve status. Only with the advent of the euro and subsuming the mark into that did Germany start to attract reserve status. Higher inflation is also something that at the margin can undermine reserve status. If you believe that a country is going to be experiencing a 10-year period of higher inflation, you don't really want to be holding that currency's cash at your bank as an idle balance earning little or no interest. So if you are expecting a country to have relatively higher inflation, that will undermine reserve status. And finally, if you're going to be a reserve currency, you really do have to be around in the future. There's no point being a reserve currency if people think that you won't exist in 5 years' time. That's pertinent with regards to the euro at the moment. So, how is the dollar holding up in the reserve currency status in this environment? Well, if we look at each of those five headings, we get a fairly mixed picture for the dollar. This chart shows the breakdown of foreign exchange reserves as we know it at the moment into the different currencies. So the dollar there, you can see the dark green lines at the bottom of the chart, has actually held up fairly well. The amount of unknown currencies in foreign exchange reserves, where central banks don't tell us their breakdown, has actually been growing in the recent past. This is mainly because the Chinese don't tell us in detail what they're doing with their currency, and their reserves have been growing. But overall, you can see that of the known reserves, the dollar has held on to its central bank reserve status relatively well in the recent past. The second choice of reserve currency today is the euro. The third choice, somewhat remarkably, is the pound sterling, which holds around 10% of known foreign exchange central bank reserves. However, although this picture does suggest that the dollar is maintaining its reserve status, there is actually a vulnerability here. This chart comes from UBS. Every year at UBS, we hold a central bank seminar at the Schloss Wolfsburg, overlooking Lake Constance. We have about 110 central bankers gathered together for a week. It is, as I'm sure you can imagine, a wild and exciting week. At this seminar, we ask the central bankers, what assets are you permitted to buy? Not what assets do you buy, because they won't tell us that, but what assets are you allowed to buy if you so choose? And I've put up here the results from 1998 and from 2007. And what you can see here is that there has been a big move into a more diverse range of assets. Back at 1998, most central bankers could actually buy US agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the mortgage-backed agency securities. But in fact, only about half of the central banks were allowed to buy those in 1998. Now pretty much all of them can. Over the course of the last 10 years or so, we've seen big leaps in the number of assets that can be bought. And central banks have become really quite daring. In 1998, virtually no central bank was able to buy mortgage bonds in the pure mortgage bond sense, like subprime mortgages and asset-backed securities. By 2007, Over 40% of banks were able to buy mortgage bonds. Not actually the best decision that central banks have ever made, but they were able to diversify their portfolios. Now, the critical point here is that if central banks are diversifying the assets into which they invest their central bank reserves, the chances are that they will also be diversifying the currency in time. They don't have to diversify the currency, but if you are running an investment strategy which is becoming more diverse as to the underlying asset, it does make sense to diversify your currency risk as well. What has happened over the last 10 years or so is that as central bank reserves have grown in size, the need to hold central bank reserves purely to intervene in the foreign exchange markets has started to diminish. And the concept of central bank reserves has changed from being a reserve asset to being a reserve plus an investment asset. But if you're going to start treating reserves as something which should also be an investment, then you want to be maximizing your return. That does not necessarily mean that you're going into dollars. What about the liquidity challenge for the dollar? Well, there are actually a number of viable alternatives to the dollar in terms of liquid markets. You don't need to have a single European bond market in order to challenge the dollar in terms of liquidity. You just need to have a large amount of euro area cash available. And we have that. Most reserves are not held in bonds or in T-bills or anything like it. Most reserves are held in bank accounts because the private sector reserves are held in cash. Central bank reserves tend to go into T-bills and go into government bonds, but private sector reserves are held in cash. When we look at the euro area today, euro area money supply is larger than that of the United States, even at prevailing market exchange rates. And what that means is that the euro does provide a credible liquid alternative, particularly for private sector reserves. Even if we look at something like sterling, sterling also provides sufficient liquidity that it could be used, if not as the dominant reserve currency, at least as a challenger reserve currency. The Japanese yen also provides sufficient liquidity. The Swiss franc does not provide a great deal of liquidity in cash. It will never be a significant reserve currency, but even in the Swiss franc, there is sufficient liquidity that it could be a small-scale challenger in terms of reserve status. When we look, therefore, at the private sector transactions, what we can see is a shift in the use of currencies. Now, this chart shows what Japanese exporters invoiced in. The line is showing their exports to the world that were invoiced in yen. 1970, in the dying days of Bretton Woods, if you wanted to buy something from Japan, you paid US dollars. The Japanese, by law, would only accept US dollars for their exports. It didn't matter whether you were from the UK or from Germany or from Latin America. You had to pay in dollars if you wanted to buy from Japan. But over time, Japanese exporters have increasingly said, actually, you know what? We're fed up with having to hedge the currency risk. Currency is now more volatile. We don't want dollars. You want to buy our cars? You pay us in yen. And today, 40% of Japan's exports are invoiced in yen. 15% of Japan's exports are invoiced in another foreign currency other than the dollar. Only 45% of Japan's exports today are invoiced in US dollars. What is particularly interesting, I think, is the dots on this chart. There has been a slow but steady rising trend of invoicing to Asia using the yen. Now that matters, because what is happening is that the yen is becoming the reserve currency of choice within the Asian region. And that, I think, is a continuing trend. Japan's volume of exports to Asia has been rising relative to its exports elsewhere in the world, largely because Japan has outsourced final stage production to parts of Asia. But it is increasingly using the yen when it sells into the Asian region. If we look at imports, we're also able to see a decline in the use of the dollar elsewhere in the world. Now, this is Australian data. Australia is, frankly speaking, a minor economy in the world. It has very little significance in terms of global economic output. As a small, open country, Australia is, in theory, very vulnerable to being bullied into having to pay US dollars for its imports. But in fact, we can see, looking at the dark green bars on this chart, Australia does not actually pay US dollars for imports in a lot of cases. We're looking at cars. It pays in a whole variety of other currencies, but cars, the bars on the right-hand side, basically none of this is going through in dollars. And in terms of exports, Australia is also diversifying away from the dollars. Now, Australian commodities are exported in dollars, and that is an important part of its economy. But other currencies are being used for invoicing when it exports other goods. In the beverage sector, over half of Australian exports are invoiced in Australian dollars. The second most important invoicing currency for Australia in the beverage sector is the pound sterling, because the reserve currency for the global beer market is the pound sterling. And Australia, therefore, invoices 20% of its beverage exports in sterling. So we are seeing a decline in the use of the dollar already taking place in the private sector. And this can be summed up in this chart here. The Federal Reserve obligingly publishes the amount of dollar cash in circulation outside the United States. This chart is showing the ratio of dollar cash to international trade. Now, if the dollar is maintaining its reserve currency status with the private sector, then you would assume that the amount of dollar cash in circulation goes up in line with the number of international transactions. You do more trade, you need more dollars to do that trade, you'll need more dollar cash. But in fact, over the course of the last 8 or 9 years, the dollar has been in decline as a share of international trade. Trade is going up, but we don't need dollars to do it. Trade is going up, but we can start to use other currencies instead. And this is reflecting the decline of the dollar as a reserve currency. In terms of the political issue, there are now problems coming through with the dollar. It is actually very, very difficult, if you are an Iranian, to hold dollars. It's also something that many people in the Middle East have become very nervous about in recent years. Why is that? In 1979, if you were an Iranian with a dollar bank account, you suddenly discovered that your dollar bank account was frozen. And it remained frozen all the way through to the late 1990s. Now, the Americans didn't steal your money. You weren't allowed to get it back. But the Americans very kindly invested it for you in short-dated US T-bills, which earned very little money at all. The politics that followed the Shah of Iran's decline meant that the dollar's reserve status was called into question. Every time we get rising political tension in the Middle East, we get an increased concern from Middle Eastern investors who are saying, actually, they stole the Iranians' money back in 79. They could steal ours now. I don't want my money held in a US bank account anymore. I don't want my money held in dollars. I want it somewhere where it's nice and safe. I want it in a different currency format. After the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein was so concerned about the threat of having Iraqi money stolen that he insisted that Iraqi oil be denominated in euros. And to make matters worse, he insisted that the money be deposited at a branch of Credit Lyonnais in order to make sure that the money was in French hands. If you are prepared to put your money in French hands, you must be in a fairly desperate situation. Along with this, we also have the issue of political posturing. Russian Prime Minister Putin is an expert at the art of posturing, politically or otherwise, and at the moment is making noises about abandoning the dollar entirely. This is coming out of geopolitics, concerns over American hostility to events in Georgia, for example. But the switching of reserves, the fact that Russia is no longer dollar pegged with its currency, but pegged loosely to a basket of euro and dollar, this is part of the process. Last week, we saw the Chinese announce discreetly that they were going to negotiate with Secretary of State Clinton to make sure that their foreign exchange reserves wouldn't go down in value. They were going to ask the Americans to guarantee the price of the Treasury bond. Now, this is absurd on very, very many levels. But China today holds approximately $1.5 trillion of foreign exchange reserves. That could cause a crisis of confidence in the financial markets if it became believed that the Chinese might dump their holdings of treasuries. There was a panic in 1995, under President Clinton, that the Japanese were going to dump their foreign holdings of US treasuries because it was feared that the trade war that was quietly building between Clinton and the Japanese would cause a crisis, and that the Japanese would then retaliate by using their foreign exchange reserves as a weapon. If you are engaged in tensions, if you are the reserve currency, but you're not as secure as you used to be, there is a risk that politics will intervene and undermine your status. And this, I think, is something that is now starting to affect the dollar in the aftermath of an imperial US world order. What about the dollar as a store of value? This chart shows central bank reserves, that's to say the domestic assets of a central bank as a share of GDP. In other words, it's printing money. The line goes up, you're printing money. Now, we can see that over the course of the last few weeks, the United States has printed a lot of money. The Federal Reserve is hose-piping liquidity into the financial system in order to ensure that investment bankers get their bonuses paid. This injection of liquidity does, in some quarters, raise a concern about the store of value of the US dollar. Does this not mean that we're going to run into inflation? Actually, I would argue that this is not an issue for the dollar as a reserve currency. We are certainly seeing an increase in the dollar money supply. But we're seeing that increase in supply because there is an increase in money demand at the moment. Liquidity preference is massive in the world economy. People want to see the cash. The result is we have no surplus money supply at this stage. Money supply, as you know, does not create inflation. It is surplus money supply that creates inflation. There is no credible threat to the dollar's store of value status from this at this stage. At some point in the future, it could be a threat if the Federal Reserve fails to withdraw liquidity from the financial system. Personally, I believe that the Fed will withdraw liquidity. We will not have an inflationary problem. The store of value issue, therefore, is not undermining the dollar as a reserve at the moment. In fact, there is potentially an issue with the euro. The store of value status for the euro is being called into question in Asia in particular, because people are questioning whether the euro survives. Now, I believe that the euro survives. I believe that it's very badly constructed. I believe that it is not an optimal currency area. There is no credible lender of last resort, and there's no central fiscal authority. Economists pointed out these problems in the 1990s. We made it very clear that the current structure of the euro was not particularly well thought out. Economists were ignored. Bad things happen when economists are ignored, and the euro's stability has been called into question. The level of the cost of leaving the euro is enormous. And as a result, I think no country will seek to leave monetary union. There will be no secession. There will be no breakup. It would be absolutely devastating to any country that sought to leave monetary union. However, in the Asian region, confronted by banking crises, confronted by divergent economics, a number of Asian investors are speculating that the euro will not exist. We have a large number of central banks as clients at UBS. In November of last year, I did my Asian tour. I saw 10 different central banks. Every single one of those central banks asked me, does the euro survive? It doesn't matter that I think it is a fantastic notion that it would be broken up. There are people in Asia prepared to indulge in that fantasy. And that is undermining the store of value that the euro offers. It won't, I think, be a persistent problem. But certainly for the next couple of years, it means the euro does not take over from the dollar as a reserve currency. So when I look at the various factors that are affecting the dollar today, what I find is that the dollar is losing reserve status, but not overwhelmingly so. It is vulnerable to central bank reserve status. Central banks are not yet reducing their holdings of dollars, but they are becoming more diverse in their investment strategies. And at some point, that could well include currency diversification. When we look at the private sector, we find that the private sector is abandoning the dollar, that countries are increasingly trying to invoice in their own currencies. The use of the dollar as a private sector reserve is fading. It's still very large, it's still very important, but it is certainly fading in this environment. The political environment is not something that is particularly conducive to the dollar adopting a dominant position as a reserve currency. And with the Middle East and Eastern Europe, there are increasingly moves away from the dollar for political reasons, as well as for economic. The dollar's store of value status, I think, remains intact, and that will not be something undermining the dollar's credibility. But it is a factor that perhaps is undermining the euro somewhat as an alternative reserve currency, at least in the near term. Why do we care about all of this? Well, for the United States, they make a profit out of being the world's reserve currency. Being the world's reserve currency is basically a vast interest-free loan from the rest of the world to you. If you can con the rest of the world into holding your cash, then you can buy goods from the rest of the world and hand over used dollar bills in exchange and effectively get an interest-free loan for purchasing foreign goods. The value of the interest-free loan, the seigniorage, if you like, is around $31 billion a year, which sounds quite impressive until you look at the size of the US current account deficit and realize it's peanuts. This is not actually a big economic benefit. There is a bigger benefit for US companies. If US companies can sell their goods in dollars and invoice their goods in dollars, they don't have to pay to manage foreign exchange risk. They don't have to hedge the currency risk. And as a result, they potentially have a lower risk and a lower cost business environment in which to operate. The rest of the world benefits from reserve currency status because basically if you have a dominant reserve currency, it is more efficient. If you have a dominant reserve currency, then all you need to do is hold reserves in the dollar and reserves in your local currency, and that's it. You can conduct international transactions with just two pots of cash. But now, with the dollar starting to decline, the world has become a little bit less efficient. We are starting to see firms having to hold dollars, of course, their local currency, but also yen or euros. And you're having to have a larger and larger number of idle cash balances in different currencies in order to conduct international trade today. Every one of those currencies has a currency risk attached to it. If you're going to hedge your currency risk, that's going to increase the cost of doing business. You're going to have to hold a certain minimum level of liquidity in each of those cash balances. Again, it's going to mean a slightly higher cost, at least a higher opportunity cost of doing business. You end up with a less efficient world economy. I believe that the dollar today is roughly where the pound sterling was in the 1920s. It is a reserve currency. It is the largest reserve currency. It's primus inter pares. But it is no longer the reserve currency. We are seeing challenges. Sterling, the yen, and the euro in particular are coming in as alternative regional currencies. And that is a trend, I think, that is going to continue in the years ahead. The problem is that that is going to make the world a less efficient place in the future. The costs of doing international business are going up, and the benefits of international trade will be undermined to some extent. But the bottom line is that the supermodels are right. You should not automatically accept dollars for doing international business in the future. That is a problem for the world economy. It is, however, a benefit for investment banks, as it means that our foreign exchange business can only grow in the years ahead. Thank you very much for your attention. I think I have a few minutes for questions, if anybody has any.
Hello. Thank you very much for the lecture. My question will be about U.S. Treasuries markets. You touched it through during the lecture. We had a flight to quality recently, and lots of money were poured into U.S. Treasuries. There is a noise in the market that it's a bubble that created by credit crisis. What's your stand? And for the last couple of days, we had the yields on them rising, and there is some concerns that the Obama administration might be not that successful in helping out the economy. So what's your stand? Do you reckon there is a bubble in this market? Do you reckon that it might be unwound? And how it will affect dollar? Thank you.
As far as Treasury is concerned, there is undoubtedly a bubble in the Treasury market. Long-term fair value for a 10-year Treasury is give or take 5%. If you assume the nominal trend rate of growth of the US economy is about 5%, which I think is a fair assessment today, that's where your 10-year nominal yield should be, give or take. However, it's not a speculative bubble that we've got in Treasuries at the moment. It's a bubble of fear. You have risk aversion sweeping the world, and as a result, investors are buying assets because they are safe, not because they are attractively priced. This was why late November of last year, the yield on a 30-day T-bill went negative. In other words, people were prepared to buy an asset guaranteeing a loss. Why were they prepared to do that? Well, if you've got over $100,000, you're not insured in the US banking system. You're sitting there and thinking, well, actually, I don't like the look of Goldman Sachs. I think they could go bankrupt. Here's hoping. Let me put that money into an asset where, yes, I've got a loss, but at least I get most of my money back at the end of the day. If I give my money to Goldman Sachs, the chances are I'll never see it again. And so you are getting this irrational fear, not necessarily irrational in the case of Goldman Sachs, but generally irrational fear, leading to investment in very, very low risk but low yielding assets. That essentially is continuing today. Now, in the past few years, central banks have been encouraging a bubble in treasury yields. Central banks are forced to buy treasury bonds very often. They're captive purchasers. Remember that slide I showed with the range of assets that central banks could buy? 10 years ago, central banks were really stuck. They could buy government bonds and that was about it. Now they can be a bit more diverse, so they have been less instrumental in creating a bond market bubble. So we now have a situation where central banks do support the bond market, but not as important as they used to be. The private sector has got a fear of the financial system, and that risk aversion is leading to support for bonds. What happens next? My instinct is that for the next year and a half, 2 years, the bubble continues. We are seeing a rise in the American savings rate. This is pretty much unprecedented, actually. Americans are actually spending less money and saving more. That increase in savings has got to go somewhere. It isn't going to go into the funds run by that nice Mr. Madoff anytime soon. It is going into the bond market. That risk aversion on the part of retail investors in America will mean, I think, that the bubble in bonds stays in place for the time being. The increase in the American savings rate this year is greater than the increase in the public sector deficit this year. That's why you've got negative growth in the States this year. The disinflation force of higher saving outweighs the stimulus of fiscal policy. The result will be, I think, that we continue to see this bubble going on until probably late 2010. At that point, if we start to see a return to risk appetite, the Federal Reserve stops being quite so accommodating, perhaps ends the credit easing policy. At that point, you're going to get a bear market in bonds, and you'll see yields rise very dramatically. Something like we saw in 1994, when we had a very dramatic sell-off in bonds. But you've got a couple of years to wait before that kicks off, I think.
Sorry, what, if any, do you think are the long-term repercussions from the stimulus packages being implemented around the world on currencies? Will they have a shifting effect on the economies, which shouldn't or can't really afford packages of these sizes that we're seeing?
As far as stimulus packages are concerned, I mean, firstly, everybody is stimulating at the same time, pretty much. Currencies are all about relative changes. That's essentially the issue. The currency is the relative price between one economy and another. And if you've got everybody pushing in the same direction at the same time, the effect is pretty much a wash. So I don't think that necessarily we should say stimulus is going to weaken any one currency in particular. In fact, stimulus today is very often being taken as a positive sign because it's actually you're doing something, you're going to help recover the economy more quickly. We've got to remember that, in fact, the most important flow for currencies is nothing to do with the bond markets at all. The flow which dominates, as far as currencies are concerned, is equities. So if you have confidence that the United States is going to recover first, then the dollar is going to be supported. If you believe that the stimulus package is going to lead to an environment where the US equity market is going to start rallying, then you're going to buy the US dollar. This, in fact, is one of the reasons why the euro has been weakening lately. If you look at global economic data in the last few months, in the United States, in the United Kingdom as well, for that matter, the data has generally been bad, but as bad as the market was expecting. There hasn't been any disappointment from the Anglo-Saxon data. The European data has consistently come in worse than the markets were expecting. You've had consistent disappointment, and that's been undermining the level of the euro. Plus, you've got Monsieur Trichet, which never is going to help. I mean, the man is mad. And as a result, what you're seeing is these draconian, the major concern of European consumers is inflation. Actually, no, the major concern of European consumers is that Deutsche Bank's going to go bankrupt and their savings will be wiped out. It's nothing to do with inflation. But with that sort of rhetoric, that anti-stimulus on the monetary policy side and a weaker stimulus on the fiscal side, the euro has been undermined. The other thing to bear in mind with the size of deficits that we're seeing at the moment is that net deficits are not necessarily going up that much. Governments normally make a profit out of a banking crisis in time. Because what you do is you acquire assets at fire sale prices. Now, I think it's safe to assume Her Majesty's government does not want to be running Royal Bank of Scotland indefinitely and deciding on whether to offer a direct saver account to the under fives or not. At some point, they're going to want to dispose of their 70-odd% stake in RBS. When they do that, the chances are they'll make a profit. And when they do that, they'll reduce the debt burden very, very rapidly. So the other issue is that with a lot of the fiscal spending we're getting at the moment, you are actually acquiring assets, which have in the long term a value. Normally it takes about 5 years to realize the profit, but that is a profit that can then be used to reduce the long-term fiscal deficit And that's something that markets will take into account.
Well, many economists, as you, predict a very long, not very long, but standard length crisis. Don't you think that it's possible that this fear disappears as in the same bubble bursting form as it appeared?
The fear of a long crisis?
The bubble that burst in a couple of days this summer, can it disappear suddenly, let's say this summer, instead of 2010?
It is possible. It would take quite a lot of mind-altering drugs to be given to large swathes of the global population. But I don't think it's going to happen. Basically, we're in the midst of a deleveraging crisis. The banking sector, in its infinite wisdom, has decided that the money it lent over the last few years was a little bit excessive, and actually it would like to see some of it come back. This gives a double shock to the global economy. Firstly, because you've now can't borrow money anymore, or you can't borrow as much money anymore. And secondly, because actually you've got to pay some of the money back. Now, for the American consumer who got to thinking that their credit card was basically another form of cash, this is a big shock. And they're all of a sudden being told to raise their savings rate. Fear of unemployment is rising, precautionary savings are rising as a consequence. So you're ending up with a large rise in the global savings rate, at least in the developed economies. 70% of the US economy is consumption. 65% of the European economy is consumption. 62% in Germany, but that's because Germans don't know how to enjoy themselves. The result is that you are seeing a big, big problem come through. Now, the consumer is a very slow-moving beast. Once the consumer is set upon a course, it's not easy to turn that course around. Conventionally, looking at the sort of deleveraging that we are seeing and the sort of levels of deleveraging the banking system wants, you would probably be talking about a 10-year cycle of sub-trend growth. However, we have also seen the largest fiscal and monetary stimulus that we have had at least in 60 years be thrown at the global economy. The consequence of that, I believe, is that we can shorten the duration of the downturn a lot and probably shorten it to a two and a half year period of very, very weak growth. And after that, you'll get the upturn. Now, I consider I'm optimistic. I think we get back to a trend-like growth environment in mid-2011. Relative to some of my peers, that is optimistic. I cannot get it happening any earlier than that unless you're going to change the psychology of the global consumer really dramatically. And I don't see that happening anytime soon.